Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Link. I'm Crispin Mwakideu in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, Kenya insists on shutting down the world's largest refugee camp at Dadaab, but questions remain over the fate of the hundreds of thousands of Somali refugees living there.
Will require resources. So we are really also appealing to donors to respond to this plan with adequate contributions, because without resources, we will not be able to carry out the plan in an adequate manner.
South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has been ordered to pay back about $500,000, money he used to upgrade his private Nkandla residence. Some South Africans say the move is too little, too late.
This just confirms and affirms my suspicion that the National Treasury is just part and parcel of the Zuma Corporation. I'm very disappointed.
7.8 million is it's not too much for a president anyway like Zuma.
Stay tuned to these stories and more right after this.
Top story.
No turning back. Kenya insists it will shut down the world's largest refugee camp in Dadaab. The first refugees to settle in this camp arrived as early as 1990, fleeing civil conflict in their homeland of Somalia. Over time, the number has grown to more than 450,000. And though conditions have slightly improved in Somalia, Kenya is at loggerheads with the United Nations on how to repatriate hundreds of thousands of refugees still stuck in Dadaab. This report by Linda Staude is now presented by Ole Tangen Jr.
Dadaab has to close, so Dadaab will be closed.
Kenyan Foreign Minister Amina Mohamed has no doubt come to terms with her government's determination to repatriate hundreds of thousands of Somali refugees living in Kenya. The UN Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, has also apparently come to terms with the controversial decision.
When I saw the president 2 weeks ago, as I told some of you, the president asked all of us to submit a plan. The plan is based on principles, voluntariness, safety and dignity, and is based also on realistic operational considerations.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, maintains that under no circumstances should Somali refugees be repatriated against their will. Somali Foreign Minister Abdusalam Omar also confirmed this.
But make no mistake, there will not be any forced repatriation. It will be a voluntary repatriation. And that's the guiding principle that all the parties agree.
According to Minister Omar, even the November 30th deadline is up for discussion following a recent meeting between the UNHCR and the governments of Somalia and Kenya.
The repatriation should be done in a humane, dignified way and under the tripartite agreement. My understanding of all that, it cannot be time-bound. It's a condition-bound, and we are happy with the progress we are making.
UNHCR's Grandi explained that by the end of the year, 150,000 Somalis will have voluntarily returned to their homeland. That's almost half of the refugees in Dadaab. Minister Mohamed has no doubt that eventually no one will refuse to go.
From all the conversations that have taken place, I haven't heard that stated. What I've heard is that there's a willingness to go back, and that the only, obviously, challenges are the packages that they take home and the safety of the places that they're returning to.
But she does not mention what will happen to those who do refuse to leave. According to Minister Omar, the Somali government has already provided land for the returnees. Commissioner Grandi says that the UNHCR will provide primary care, schools and hospitals, and will increase severance packages.
Will require resources. So we are really also appealing to donors to respond to this plan with adequate contributions, because without resources, we will not be able to carry out the plan in an adequate manner.
The Kenyan government estimates that the closure of Dadaab will cost a minimum of 200 million euros, of which 190 million will have to come from the international community. Minister Mohamed stresses that the interests of the refugees must take precedence in the discussions.
The emphasis has to be on the dignity of the refugees, the need for hope, and for a future for them. And I don't think that the Dadaab camps provide any of that. They don't provide hope, they don't provide dignity, and they definitely do not give them any sense of a secure future.
And that story was compiled by Linda Staude. So what do Somalis themselves think about Kenya's idea to send half of Dadaab's refugees back to Somalia by November? I put that question to Fadumo Dayib, a Somali politician and presidential aspirant.
I think this is impractical. It is not going to be possible to relocate almost more than 150,000 refugees. Furthermore, I think it is inhumane to forcefully return these refugees to Somalia, because if you look at the concept of voluntarily returning, or what is actually voluntariness, it's, you know, according to UNHCR, you know, an absence of any physical, psychological or material pressure. And this decision is far from any of this.
Do these Somali refugees in Dadaab really want to go back, in your opinion?
I don't think they want to go back. They've lived there for 25 years. They have children who have been born there and who have studied, and some of them are still studying. You know, the Dadaab closure is a violation of international law. Deporting all these refugees, we are not talking about voluntary repatriation, it is far from that, you know, back to Somalia. At this point of time, when, you know, insecurity is really a major issue in Somalia, is impractical, but it is also inhumane.
But again, Kenya argues that they had this tripartite agreement with the UN, Somalia and Kenya itself, that the camp should be closed down.
Well, actually, the fact that Kenya went and had discussions with a region in Somalia to try and get this region to accept the return of these refugees is actually also a violation of that, of the 2013 tripartite agreement. And furthermore, it is actually against the principle of non-refoulement. You cannot force these refugees to go back. They don't want to go back. They don't have anywhere to go back to. Where are you going to resettle them? In a country that is just coming back on its knees, that needs to get its, you know, security and a lot of other issues into place. I mean, where are you returning them to? I think the Kenyan government is trying to do this exercise to gain attention for other issues. I don't think they mean this seriously.
They've been also saying that they're closing down the camp, or they reached that decision because of insecurity fears. Isn't that a valid argument?
No one has been able to show any evidence that any of the terrorist attacks in Kenya were committed by refugees in Dadaab or from Dadaab. And you know, this is really very dangerous, and I think it is unnecessary. These people are already suffering. They have been without a country for 25 years. Some of them are unable to make, you know, livelihoods. Their kids are suffering. On top of that, to be labeled as terrorists is, I think, also really inhumane as well.
Somali politician and presidential aspirant Fadumo Dayib.
Africa Link, every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
Too little, too late. South Africa's Treasury on Monday ordered President Jacob Zuma to pay back 7.8 million rand, or $500,000, which he used for non-security upgrades on his private Nkandla residence. The work included a swimming pool, which was claimed to be a firefighting facility, a chicken run, a cattle enclosure, an amphitheatre and a visitor's centre. Nkandla is one of several scandals that have dogged Zuma's presidency. Tuzo Komalo has been describing to me the reactions following the order by the Treasury.
The reaction has been mixed. There are some who are saying it is too little comparing to the 246 million that was being talked about, estimated by many people, that was spent on Nkandla. People saying he should have been at least been paying a half of that amount. Some of them saying at least one quarter would have done it. But there are some who are also saying what is important here is not only about the amount, but the fact that the president has been made to account, and he has agreed that he's going to account and pay back. So they are saying the symbol of it, the symbolism of it, is very crucial to say no one is above the law, even the state president can pay. And a number of South Africans saying different views. Let's hear what they have to say.
I really find it strange, and this just confirms and affirms my suspicion that the National Treasury is just part and parcel of the Zuma Corporation. I'm very disappointed.
I'm in disagreement with it because it is less than a tenth of what he spent on building that house. He won't take the department seriously because he sees how lenient they are with him. And I think what they've done is not correct.
My other part is happy that is finally taking responsibility, but my other part says the responsibility is too little for him. 7.8 million is not too much for a president anyway, like Zuma.
A section of South Africans there giving their reactions to the Treasury's order that President Zuma should pay $500,000 as reimbursement for Nkandla upgrade. Now, despite the Nkandla scandal and other corruption-related allegations, the ruling African National Congress continues to back President Zuma. But is that support also present amongst ordinary South Africans?
It is a bit surprising because every time Zuma does something that people think the man is down, he comes up. Recently, he has held meetings and I can tell you he was filling stadiums. He had a lot of support, even in the wake of the violence that we have seen in Pretoria, in Tshwane, where people were revolting against some of the people that were nominated by the ANC to stand as mayors and councillors. We still see Zuma even getting support from the grassroots. So I think it's about the ANC and what it has done for the people more than what Zuma is doing now. A lot of people are saying this is the ANC that liberated them. It has given them houses. It has given them electricity. So you've got a large number of people that are prepared to support Zuma in whatever he does. But of course, the numbers of those that are saying Zuma must go, Zuma is messing up the country, is also increasing. That cannot be ignored. But he still gets a lot of support from the traditional ANC members on the ground.
Tuzo Kumalo in Johannesburg.
Africa on the move.
In Kenya, it's known as Nyama Choma, but in South Africa, it is called Shisa Nyama. Customers select meat in small butchers' shops, which is then grilled right in front of them. It's a well-known concept that Max Mkadi took a step further by setting up a prospering company called Max Lifestyle in Omlanzi, a township near Durban. And the business has turned Max into a self-made millionaire. Leonie Match went along to visit the restaurant and her report is presented by Sarah Steffen.
South African Kwaito beats blast through the speakers as well-dressed customers enjoy their drinks here on a spacious patio. The smell of roasting meat hangs in the air. Max Mgadi is the owner of the restaurant. Now a successful businessman, he worked hard to get here, he says.
So whenever I started, it was just a butchery, a small shisa nyama. And that time, now it's been 15 years, and it was a shakes where you come and buy the meat during the weekends. And then I said, no, people, they demanding to me to build this establishment, to develop, to make this place looks like this.
The 45-year-old is proud of his achievements and his fancy restaurant. A stairway leads up from the patio to a lavish VIP lounge with white leather armchairs and sofas, where the bar serves a selection of expensive whiskies. Photos on the wall show the self-made millionaire amid ministers, actresses, and businessmen.
I was nothing. I come nowhere. No one knows about me. Even I was going to say, I put him in, no one was going to care about me. That is where we respect people, where they're coming from. If you grow rich, we don't have that much respect because you have a nice background. We are coming from nothing to have something where we are. So everything starts in the township. Even our leader, they grow up in the township, so they make it in the township. So I sacrifice, I compromise so many things to put this thing in this standard. So today they know Oguti who's makes.
But the businessman doesn't just care about boosting his own image, he also wants to develop his neighborhood. He employs 80 people as well as some temp workers, security guards and parking attendants. It's mostly young people who wouldn't have a job if it wasn't for him. Unemployment rates in townships like Umlazi are high. Max Mgadi approaches a table where he shakes everyone's hand. It's a true rainbow nation here, he says, and his food helps with that.
My achievement It was see the rainbow nation sitting together, see Indian eating and the white eating in the one plate with the blacks, to understand our culture, how the blacks they do, what type of a food they eat. So, and that thing is making our province becoming so popular. There was a Holland, there was German in this place. So this place, it's a train center. And now our plan is to have a boutique hotel without coming visiting during the day, sleep in the township.
His next project is going to be a fancy boutique hotel right next to the restaurant. It might just be the next chapter of his success story.
And that story was written by Leonie March. Let's head to South Sudan now, where a strike by more than 3,000 university lecturers has crippled higher education. Tutors have ignored threats by their cash-strapped government to either resume teaching or risk losing their jobs. As James Shimanyula reports, South Sudan's oil-dependent economy has been battered by low crude prices and a civil war which destroyed much of the oil infrastructure.
Controversy surrounds the striking university lecturers in South Sudan. Without specifying the date, a senior government officer in the Ministry of Information, Michael Makwey, stated that lecturers would be paid next week.
Government of South Sudan is doing its level best, and within this coming week they will be paid. If it is a question of salary, the salary will be paid this coming week.
But on the contrary, Higher Education Minister Peter Adok Nyaba has threatened to sack the lecturers if they fail to resume work as soon as possible. The letter has angered the lecturers. Their spokesman, Philip Apollo, has this strong rider to the minister.
The minister apologized to the academic staff on his letter. Failure to withdraw the letter will ask for the removal of the minister. The strike goes ahead.
The lecturers went on strike claiming that they have not been paid for 3 months. Minister of Higher Education Peter Adok Nyaba explains.
Once there is money, they will be paid. Regarding their allowance, which are in arrears, they will also be paid as soon as the country is in a position to pay.
More than 3,000 lecturers are taking part in the strike. This is what some of them had to say.
The nature of our work requires that we stand for 3 hours per class. And if you have 2 classes, you've got to stand for 6 hours, knowing very well that without energy in the body, one can even collapse in the class.
We shall still stand with our rights because we have taken that decision, and some of us come from far distance to give lectures, and some of us even are renting, and now 3 months without anything, even feeding, is becoming a problem.
The lowest paid university lecturer in South Sudan earns $250 per month, while the highest paid lecturer pockets $450, excluding house, medical, and transport allowances. Their strike comes just 8 weeks after the new government of national unity took office. The government in Juba is yet to recover from more than 2 years of civil war that compelled operators of oil industries to stop production. Oil accounts for 98% of South Sudan's economy. The 5 South Sudan public universities taking part in the strike are Juba, Upper Nile, Bahar El Ghazal, Rumbek, and Dr. Johnny Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology.
DW correspondent James Shimanyula in Nairobi.
Making a difference.
And action. That's the life of Mala Tabot, a young Cameroonian who uses street theatre to teach young people how they could protect themselves from HIV and early pregnancies. Her project has been able to reach out to at least 1 million Cameroonian youths. Her work has been recognised internationally. Moki Kinzeka met Mala Tabot and now brings us this report.
Hundreds of men and women are gathered here at Eshobi village near the southern Cameroonian town of Mamfe. they are keenly watching a drama piece. It has been prepared and presented by Mala Thabot's United Vision Cameroon Group. The theatrical performance encourages men to assist their wives in maternal health care. Among the curious men is 25-year-old Rigobert Mbong, who says he was invited with his wife, but he did not deem it necessary coming along with her since she is 4 months pregnant.
The positive part of the drama was when I saw a pregnant woman trying to force the husband to assist her go to the clinic. And the negative part that really made me to weep was when I saw how the girl was also weeping due to the fact that the husband never wanted her to go to the clinic, just fighting for land.
After watching the play, 37-year-old Nkongo Alex, who did not come with his pregnant wife because she had to stay behind and take care of their children, says the drama has transformed the way he thinks about his wife's pregnancy.
I've taken upon it as a responsibility. When I go at home, my wife will realize there will be changes. I think the first thing that I will do, I will surprise her. When she will be going for this maternal care thing, I will follow her. And when I will tell her that I want to follow her, she will be doubting what is happening. It's because the United Vision Health has made me to acquire knowledge about it.
And Nkongo Alex and others who came to watch the performance can thank Mala Thabot for it. The 27-year-old is the creative brain behind the artistic work. She explains to me the source of her inspiration.
My mother was much younger than me when she had 6 children. And I grew up to watch her struggle to raise all 6 as a young girl, you know, just caught up in the body of a mother. Growing up later in my life, I came to understand that one of the reasons why she found herself in the situation was because of lack of choice. So she didn't have access to information and knowledge about birth control and access to contraception.
Interestingly, Mala's role model and icon is male and no longer alive. Even more interesting is that he is considered as Africa's Che Guevara. That's the late Burkinabe leader Thomas Sankara, who led the West African nation from 1983 to 1987. Mala says he still admires what Sankara stood for.
Thomas Sankara, he was one of the few African male leaders who stood up for gender equality.
Mala adds that she decided to use theater as a means of communicating with the youth on issues of health because it leaves a stronger impact on viewers.
You go to community, if you just talk blah, 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 people say, okay, I've heard, and then it's bye-bye. But then if you engage them with using like strong community tools such as theater, then people act more and people make better decisions. The power of theater was evident because just right at the end of the show, people just queued up in front of the health center to receive those services.
Mala has been recognized by many in Cameroon as a community developer. Her fight against trends and tendencies that relegate women and girl children to the background has once earned her a place at the table with Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II of England.
DW correspondent Moki Kinzeka in Yaoundé. And before we leave, here's a reminder of our main stories. Kenya insists it will shut down the Dadaab refugee camp. South Africa's Treasury has ordered President Jacob Zuma to pay over $500,000, part of taxpayers' money Zuma used to upgrade his private Nkandla residence. And we've also been hearing about a lecturer's strike in South Sudan. That's all we have. Do send us your comments and suggestions on the program either via text message to country code 49160-957-59510, an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or a letter to Africa Link 53110 Bonn, Germany. For more news, visit dw.com/Africa. From me, Crispin Mwakideu, have a good day.